Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Good evening and welcome, or good morning, or good night, or good afternoon, or, yeah, hi world. Welcome to this, the 15th day of November edition, 2012, of The Horn, headonradionetwork.com, an internet-based radio program, available on a wide variety of platforms, places like TuneIn Radio and Tuner Internet Radio app and Stitcher, which also has I think record functions are being integrated on many of these apps. But Dar.fm, Streama.com, Roku devices. Yeah. We're getting downright ubiquitous. The easiest way to listen to The Horn, of course, is by going to headonradionetwork.com and simply clicking the Listen Live button. But that doesn't always work on machines that don't, well, like smartphones and stuff that don't do well with Java or Flash or whatnot or what have you. But, well, by all means, use any method you want to access conversation radio. Hi. I'm Bob Kincaid, and this is Thorn in the Side Thursday on The Horn. The Horn, by the way, is supported entirely by listeners. It is listener contributions that keep everything humming along here. And I am proud to say that we are here at the halfway point of November, only 113 away from being at the halfway mark for the month of November. We haven't updated the little bar graph yet, but it should be updated to reflect $3,000 a month based on the bad math that I was doing all along. But at any rate, if we bring in $103, I think, I don't know, either $163 or $103, I'm not sure which. Math is not my strong suit. But we will draw even for where we need to be this month. A little program note, please. Jot this down. If you want to. I mean, I'm not telling you to do anything. I will be away from the microphone tomorrow evening. I have a meeting that a gathering that must needs be attended. Connected with the 8 campaign. We're pretty happy inside the 8 campaign tonight. I'll tell you why. Had rather of a big victory today. Not just for the 8 campaign, but for everybody who is engaged in the struggle against the slow-rolling genocide that is mountaintop removal in Appalachia. Big news. Oh, by the way, we will get to the conversation portion of the program fairly shortly. Let me get the phone numbers out there, 304-658-3333. And one of these days, when we can end the hostage crisis that involves our toll-free number, we'll start using that again. But 304-658-3333. And on Skype, you can reach the program. And our account is Bob Kincaid Horn. B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D H-O-R-N. I'm signing into the Skype account right now. If you've never contacted us by Skype or you aren't friended up with that account, just send me a note and I'll approve it and we'll start conversing. Now, there was a rather big announcement today in the struggle against mountaintop removal. You know, Patriot Coal is in bankruptcy. Patriot Coal, of course, runs the largest mountaintop removal operation in West Virginia. It's called the Hobet Mine Complex. It is a massive toxic waste dump that has plagued residents in that area for years and will for years more. They've got a lot of other holdings as well. But, and this has nothing to do with the Obama war on coal, and everything instead to do with the free market, which apparently the coal industry doesn't think much of all of a sudden. Patriot Coal got itself in some hot legal waters over the poisons that it has been pumping off of its mountaintop removal sites and into the waters of the state of West Virginia and by extension of the United States of America. Selenium is a particular problem. Just because it's in your vitamins doesn't mean that you need to bathe in it. But they sat down to settlement negotiations with a couple of grassroots groups, the Sierra Club, and a law office here called the Appalachian Mountain Defense Firm. And the result of that, those negotiations, was announced today in a joint statement approved by the court. Patriot Coal, which was originally, by the way, you just need to know, this is just deep background. Patriot Coal was created when Peabody Coal got out of the region and dumped all of its holdings onto this newly created creature, Patriot, as a way of dodging its own liabilities. Curiously, Patriot and Peabody and Arch are all headquartered in St. Louis, far, far away from the filth and mess and disasters that they create. But as a result of these settlement negotiations, Patriot, which is in bad financial shape, came to a business-based conclusion based on sound principles of business. They are getting out of the mountaintop removal business. The president and CEO of Ben Hatfield signed off on a plan that will get Patriot Coal out of the mountaintop removal business some years from now. What they've agreed to is that they will only blast away mountains that they have presently leased on permits that they presently have, and will, when those are run out, never do it again. Even more stunning is the statement by Ben Hatfield, president and CEO of Patriot. It's not just a statement, it's an admission. Patriot Coal recognizes that our mining operations impact the communities in which we operate in significant ways, and we are committed to maximizing the benefits of this agreement for our stakeholders, including our employees and neighbors. We believe the proposed settlement will result in a reduction of our environmental footprint. That "we believe" language kind of gives me pause for concern. It's a little sketchy. But still, it means that the leases they have are all they're going to do. It remains to be seen, and a close reading, and there yet needs to be a close reading of the settlement agreement, but it remains to be seen as to what would happen if they would sell off, say, some of those leases and permits to another outfit. They would then be within the letter of the agreement, but certainly not the spirit of it. This is a big deal. This is a very big deal. This is one company getting out of the business of poisoning West Virginians and Appalachian people, from babies in the womb all the way to our senior citizens. Because no one who lives near a mountaintop removal operation can get away from the poisons. You breathe it. It falls from the air in rain. In many instances, if people have wells, their well water is contaminated or poisoned. It is inescapable. But that statement, Patriot Coal recognizes that our mining operations impact the communities in which we operate in significant ways, is as close as any coal company has ever gotten to admitting the breadth and scope of what they have for so many years done to the people of Appalachia. And that's about as much as he could say. I mean, there's no way that the CEO of Patriot Coal is going to walk into open court and say, "Your Honor, Patriot Coal recognizes that we've been poisoning people for a lot of years now." Because that would just open the lawsuit floodgates. Because there's tons of science out there. If you've listened to this program, you know it. There's tons of science out there that rather pointedly makes the case that living near a mountaintop removal can be, in some cases, fatal. And in many others, deeply harmful to trying to go on being a relatively normal, living, breathing human being next to such neighbors. What I find most fascinating out of this, however, is that lo and behold, with them agreeing to a basically self-imposed moratorium on their mountaintop removal activities, they are actually tracking the theoretical and philosophical underpinnings of the AIC Act. You know about the AIC Act. You know where to learn about the AIC Act. ACHEACT.ORG, AIC Act.org, part of which is to impose a moratorium on mountaintop removal pending a fully funded federal study of the effects mountaintop removal has on the communities near it. It sounds like Patriot Coal has already recognized some of those effects and wants to get far, far away from it before the lawsuits start getting filed. And of course, the Horn family have been a monumental presence in helping us get the AIC Act going. The AIC team today issued a press release based upon this news. You can see the text of the press release on the Thursday, November 15th, 2012 show post, today's show post at headonradionetwork.com. I'm pulling it up right now. Maybe I am. There we go. Today, said the AIC team, Patriot Coal Corporation agreed to cease mountaintop removal mining. In a settlement with citizens groups Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, West Virginia Highlands Conservancy, and Sierra Club, Patriot concluded that the continuation or expansion of surface mining is not in its long-term interests. That's important language, too. That means it no longer makes economic sense if it turns out that science is going to prove that they have terrible, bone-breaking, crushing liabilities to the people they've poisoned already. The groups were represented by Appalachian Mountain Advocates. The company stated, Patriot stated, well, we've gone through that. The Appalachian Community Health Emergency Act campaign welcomed the news, adding that all Appalachian communities need protection through passage of the AIC Act. My friend and colleague, Bo Webb, co-founder of the AIC campaign, said, this admission and action by Patriot Coal is a clear mandate to the U.S. Congress to immediately pass the AIC Act into law, providing an immediate pause on all new mountaintop removal permits and a health study to address the effects of MTR on human beings. Until then, mountain removers will continue to jeopardize thousands of citizens' lives while state agencies do nothing to protect us. And that's the truth. The West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection is a walking, talking, breathing joke. It is nothing but a wholly owned subsidiary of the coal industry itself. But Webb continued, we've been exposed to hazards such as toxic blasting dust for years and are now experiencing the long-term health impacts. I'm tired of watching my family and neighbors die. At present, the AIC Act, in large part through your efforts, has 27 co-sponsors in the House of Representatives. My friends and colleagues, Bo Webb and Mickey McCoy, Mike Rozelle, and Antrim Caskey, are all in D.C. right now working to add to that number. This agreement is a clear admission of the dangers of mountaintop removal coal mining and a key victory for the Appalachian community, said Congressman John Yarmuth of Kentucky's 3rd Congressional District. I commend Patriot Coal for acknowledging the destructive impact of mountaintop removal and for taking steps to protect the communities where it operates. An industry leader finally recognizing that it can be successful without employing this devastating practice is significant progress. Now it's time for Congress to step up and enact legislation protecting all of Appalachia. U.S. Representative Louise M. Slaughter, native of Harlan County, Kentucky, said, when industry representatives admit to the dangers of mountaintop removal mining, there can be no more excuse for inaction or delay. The Appalachian community has fought hard for today's settlement. It is high time that the federal government join the fight to end mountaintop removal and protect additional Appalachian communities from similar threats to the environment and public health. My dear friend Debbie Gerald, also a part of the AIC team, one of the co-directors at Coal River Mountain Watch, added, for a company to admit that it's harming the community is a major step, but we can't wait for all the companies to end mountaintop removal out of the goodness of their hearts. Citizens have pleaded with Alpha Natural Resources, Arch Coal, and others for decades to stop this abominable practice, but our pleas have fallen on deaf ears, and government agencies have not ended the practice. I worry for my grandchildren's health and for the health of everyone in the community. Patriot is showing that a company doesn't have to threaten its neighbor's health and that mountaintop removal is unnecessary. Another good friend of mine is Mickey McCoy. He's a Kentuckian down Inez way. He said, I pray this action by Patriot Coal to halt the impact of man's destructive abomination upon God's creation might serve as a catalyst for the U.S. Congress to expedite the enactment of H.R. 5959, reducing cancer death rates and birth defects of children within the human race who reside in Appalachia. You know about that growing body of scientific evidence because you're a regular listener to The Horn that suggests all the myriad threats to which an unborn child is subjected simply for being carried in the womb of a mother whose family for generations, perhaps, has lived in Appalachia but has had predatory coal companies, parasitic coal companies, move into the mountains behind, before, or around her and begin the blasting and the poisoning that will make it difficult for her beloved unborn child to ever take a single easy breath. This is a great time to redouble our efforts on behalf of the AIC Act. It would be great if everybody within the sound of my voice would go to AICACT.org, learn what the AIC Act will do, much of what we've just discussed, and then contact your member of Congress, your member of the House of Representatives. There's a lame duck session, and there's no time like the present to get signers. Don't send me emails saying, "Well, Bob, I would, but my representative is a Republican." No. You don't give them up for lost just because they're Republicans. You contact them. If your representative is a Republican, you talk about the impact on unborn children. You talk about, because Republicans will love to worry about money, you talk about the hundreds of millions of dollars per year that mountaintop removal-related illnesses cost us. If you have, if you've already contacted your elected representative and they've already signed onto the AIC Act, send them a thank you note and say you can't wait to see it reintroduced in the next Congress, and you hope they'll be right there chomping at the bit to do it. But the fact of the matter is, we need some Republicans on co-sponsors on this bill. We need them badly. If all of that talk about wanting to find something that we can agree on in the Congress has any truth to it, then this is the bill. This ought to be easy for a Texas pro-oil Republican to sign. Even, as much as I hate to say it, a pro-natural gas Republican. Sign on. Save the baby hillbillies. They can be brought on, but it will take the dedicated, determined efforts of you and people like you. You do it and then send it out to your email list. I refrain from telling people to be the go do this, go do that guy, but in this instance, I won't refrain. We have a chance, and we have been shown today that we have a chance to end mountaintop removal now, in the next year. It can be done. We're going to start a little bit of pressure as well on the White House to acknowledge the existence of the AIC Act and to say we support it. Why not? The coal industry already constructed a phony baloney war on coal. How about the people defending lives get a say so as well? Because while the war on coal is a bunch of baloney, the war on us is not. And like Bo Webb said, it gets tiresome watching your neighbors and your friends and your loved ones die when they need not have. 4 4,000, in excess of 4,000. Excess deaths happen every year in West Virginia alone in communities where mountaintop removal is the nearest neighbor. Patriot was smart to get out while it could. The other companies, however, we don't know how smart they are. We think they're going to have to be stopped. They're not going to voluntarily get out. Michael asking, Bob, can you right quick remind us what companies besides Patriot currently do MTR? I admit I should probably know all the names, but I want to have them handy to remind people who seem to think that the game is over and I should stop talking about MTR now. Don't stop, Michael. The game, the struggle is far from over. The chief among mountaintop removal companies is Massey Energy. Or not Massey Energy, what used to be Massey Energy. It's now Alpha Natural Resources. Arch Coal also does it. In other parts of the country, which of course are not Appalachia and aren't affected by the ACAT, there's all kinds of surface and strip and filthy pit mining being done by outfits like Peabody, which, like I said, set up Patriot as a shell corporation to hand off its bad debts to. But primarily, Patriot, Arch, and foremostly, Alpha Natural Resources. But Michael brings up another important topic, too. Whenever we score a victory, something as significant as this, and we spend a little bit of time patting each other on the back, I guess I'm just Debbie Downer. But my first inclination is, all right, coffee break's over, back on your heads. Because, one, this agreement that Patriot has entered into that says it will never do it again, they're going to be mining for years on mountaintop removal operations. This just means that once they're done, they won't do it anymore. And it confirms their duty to clean up their mess. I always think of the aftermath of the... I know, I'm sorry. I'm a redneck. I'm a southern boy. And southern history is a part of me. And I always think about the aftermath of the First Battle of Manassas, First Bull Run, as it's called. After the Southern troops had rallied and put the Northern forces into full flight, headlong, disorganized, chaotic retreat, heading back toward Washington, D.C. as quickly as they could go, throwing off shoes, coats, belts, bullets, cartridges, firearms, whatever they had, getting rid of it just to try to get away from the killers behind them. Some historians have argued that the South actually had its greatest opportunity on that day to force a settlement. Which would have been an awful settlement. But that opportunity slipped through their hands because the bedraggled, ragged men of that Southern Army stopped to party. Look at all this food, boys. We're going to eat good for a couple days. Look at that bacon and coffee and flour. Look at these here fancy new shooting guns. I reckon I can put the old squirrel rifle away. And they stopped to divvy up the booty instead of running the enemy to the ground and destroying that army once and for all. And because of that, that army was able to reorganize and fight again and protect Washington, D.C. To a certain extent, that happened politically in the aftermath of Watergate. Well, we ran that damn Nixon out of there. crook. Reckon we've preserved government now, and everything will be all right, and we'll clean things up, and we won't have another Nixon. And it was a scant 6 years before I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear, and it was on again. Because we stopped to congratulate ourselves. So revel in this. Enjoy this. Take pride in this. I'm awfully proud of the Sierra Club for what they did to press this issue forward. I'm proud for OVEC and the Highlands Conservancy. I'm proudest of all, however, of all those people who, in whatever way they can, be they in Appalachia or outside Appalachia, who've done whatever they can to end this. Calls have been made, letters written to Congress, letters have been written to the editor of newspapers. The story has spread until the coal industry could no longer hide its filthy little secret deep in the hills, or what used to be hills and what used to be hollers, and were subsequently turned into vast, barren, dead moonscapes that a crow flying across would have to pack a meal to cross, were made public. But we cannot stop and congratulate ourselves. In the name of those 4,000 people per year, we dare not. Now is the time to act on the words of John Yarmouth and Louise Slaughter. Now is the time to press home the AIC Act and not just stop it on Patriot sites, but stop it on Alphas. Stop it on Arches. Stop it. Over at the highly influential Coal Tattoo blog today, Ken Ward had a post asking a question that a lot of us have been asking in a larger context of late. In a post entitled "Obama and Coal, Does the Mining Industry Not Understand Who Won the Presidential Election?" Mr. Ward goes into great detail to explain how the coal industry is responding in the wake of the Obama victory. The Kentucky Coal Association, the West Virginia Coal Association. Let's see. Bill Bissett is the president of the Kentucky Coal Association. He said, a lot of his disfavor here is connected directly to the fact that, is connected directly to his anti-coal policies. It is our hope that this message was heard by the president and that perhaps he changes his position. What message would that be? The message that Bishop Willard Romney, that Kentucky and West Virginia supported, took an ass whooping? Millions of dollars were spent by the coal industry on candidates in the congressional races as well as on the presidential race. They lost their ass in the presidential race. And Ken Ward notes that war on coal candidates lost 6 key Senate races around the country. And while coal regions of individual states went for Bishop Willard raw money, they couldn't counteract the effects in the rest of the civilized portions of the state. Coal counties in Ohio went for raw money. They went for raw money in Virginia, too. But Virginia and Ohio went for Obama. A couple of coal counties went for Bishop Willard in Colorado. But Obama won Colorado. There's disgusting amounts of strip mining in southern Illinois, the homeland that our buddy Jeff Biggers wrote about so eloquently on in Reckoning at Eagle Creek. But Illinois went for President Obama. Yeah, they mine coal in Alabama, and they even mine some in Texas, and I guess they're trying to get some lignite in Arkansas. There might even still be some coal mining in Oklahoma, Stan. But those states did not go for Bishop Willard because of the war on coal money or the war on coal rhetoric. Those states went for Bishop Willard because the president is blah. But also buried down in Mr. Ward's post is a reference to something that my junior senator, Joe Manchin, is now saying. Joe Manchin wants President Obama to tour Appalachia on what he calls a healing tour. I guess he's supposed to come to, well, I don't know. WTRF, CBS 7, reported back on the 6th of November on Senator Manchin. And reported that healing tour business. He suggested that the next president, now known to be Obama, should go on a presidential healing tour, looking at the potential in each state, and invited him to start in West Virginia. Be careful what you wish for, Joe Blanche. Because, see, what he means by healing tour is he wants Barack Obama to come here and repeat the West Virginia Coal Association's advertising slogan for them again, like he did at the memorial for the Upper Big Branch disaster. You know, coal keeps the lights on. He wants him to come here and make nicey nice with the coal workers. But there's one thing Joe Manchin doesn't want to have happen. Joe Manchin would have all the blood drain out of his pasty face, and his a few of them perfect hairs might even get out of place, if Barack Obama was to come to West Virginia and say, go and sit down for a cup of coffee with Maria Gano, underneath the looming shadow of a mountaintop removal action. No, Joe Manchin would have to change his shorts if he heard that his healing tour invitation had been taken up by the President of the United States and that Barack Obama was going to go down Coal River Way and pay a little visit to Beau Webb. Because, you know, you look straight across past the family cemetery at Bowes and straight up the hill, that's a mountaintop removal site. And there's poison dust that rains down on the hymn day in and day out. and everybody in that community. Those friends and neighbors Bo mentioned in the press release that are he's sick of watching die, that's why they're a-dying. Because their nearest neighbor is Alpha Natural Resources, formerly Massey. Massively mountaintop removers. I'd love to see that happen. Might yet work on a White House petition. We've been talking about it some on the last couple of nights. But then I got to thinking about it. Bo and his lovely wife are genial folks and lovely hosts. And the place where they live, were it not for the nightmare above them, would be a little slice of paradise as the creek babbles merrily by their homestead. It's a lovely little corner of the world. If some of that world was still there and hadn't been blown to smithereens. But the soil around Bo's place is toxic. It's chock-a-block with polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, toxic Pandora's boxes of just about every nasty cancer-causing petroleum-based agent you can imagine. Polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons are a byproduct of incomplete combustion of hydrocarbons. And the ground is filthy with them. And the air is choked with mountaintop removal dust from those explosions. Little less than 10 micron sized particles of blasted sandstone that if you look at them under a microscope, look like jagged glass. And at the level on which they operate on the human respiratory system, they act just like jagged glass. There's a lovely old apple tree that grows off to the side of Emily's cemetery. It was loaded with apples this year. But he showed me one day why he wasn't eating the apples. Plucked one off the tree, and it was covered in these greasy black dots, splotches. And you could rub one of those splotches with your thumb, and they'd smear, greasy-like. But I got to wondering, as wonderful a host as Bo is, and as lovely a setting as that is, notwithstanding the mountaintop removal site, I wonder if the Secret Service would even allow President Obama to visit there. And that's without even taking into account all the hateful, vicious, vitriolic rhetoric that has run around this, the arguably most racist state in the Union. Just to be there and breathe the air. To be on the ground might be too much of a risk for the Secret Service to tolerate for their charge. I don't know. but it is a great day. Enjoy the victory. Revel in it. But only for a short time. Because there remains tremendous amounts of work to be done. But we have in this a degree of confirmation that is work that will indeed likely have a payoff. And it will be the sweetest payoff in the world. Because the payoff will be a payoff for little 8-year-old hillbilly children who get to be 9-year-old hillbilly children. The payoff will be for the granddaddies who have waited for their grandson to get old enough to take fishing. The payoff will be for new mamas who lean over the crib and watch their children, their newborn babies, breathing regular, even, and easily through the night. And I'll take a payoff like that over any payoff Wall Street has to offer on its share prices, or any payoff that the Powerball might have on any given Saturday night. Because that will pay off in smiles, and that will pay off in laughter, and that will pay off in families and communities that can simply live. And that will be worth more money than any coal baron has ever acquired or even dreamt of. And when it happens, you'll say, we made that happen. That happened because we refused to sit idly by. That happened because we cared enough to make the change we wanted. So we'll take a little break, open the lines for your calls. Mercy sakes, there's a whole bunch of other stories out there this evening. And some real Lulus at that. I mean, this is Thorn in the Side Thursday, and don't think that I just came in and said we're going to do this. No. No, I got some Thorn in the Side Thursday stories. You know the number, right? 304-658-3333. Or if you want to, you can connect on Skype. Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D. Horn, H-O-R-N, Bob Kincaid, Horn. The Green News Report with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen is on the way. And do please remember that we're very close to meeting our fundraising goal for this far into the month. We're right on top of the halfway mark, and we can get there tonight. We kind of need to, because there's no show tomorrow night. So light up the phones. Fire up the email. Jump into the chat room. Head on radionetwork.com/chatroom. And let's see what another evening of this little experiment in freeform conversation brings. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
sing them lonesome songs. I can't tell by the way I feel that it comes from somewhere real, like that sweet mountain soul down in my bones.
It's Thursday, November 15, 2012.
Justice in the Gulf?
BP has agreed to plead guilty to all 14 criminal charges.
BP to pay record fines for largest oil spill in nation's history. California launches landmark cap and trade system. October 2012, the second hottest October on record. Plus,
climate change is real, that it is impacted by human behavior and carbon emissions. And as a consequence, I think we've got an obligation to future generations to do something about it.
The Superstorm Sandy effect. Obama says it's time to tackle climate change. Sort of.
All of that and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
The reason why you had BP being such a problem, Adam, is because it was so far offshore. And the reason why it was so far offshore is because of environmental reasons.
And also because that's where the oil is. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, a very, very big news day today. Finally, some good-ish news out of the Gulf.
Yeah, some accountability. Oil giant BP will pay a record fine and plead guilty to unprecedented felony criminal charges for the disastrous 2010 Gulf of Mexico oil spill, the worst in the nation's history. The $4.5 billion settlement includes a record $1.3 billion fine, $3 billion in penalties and other payments to federal agencies, and 14 criminal charges that include 11 felony manslaughter counts for the deaths of 11 crew members, and three high-ranking BP supervisors have been indicted on felony manslaughter and obstruction of justice charges. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, in a press conference on Thursday, called it unprecedented.
BP has agreed to plead guilty to all 14 criminal charges, including responsibility for the deaths of 11 people and the events that led to an unprecedented environmental catastrophe.
So the company has agreed to plead guilty to 11 charges of manslaughter. Who is going to jail on behalf of the company for that manslaughter?
No one. The company does not go to jail, but it is possible those three supervisors could go to jail after trial.
So that whole thing about corporations being people, pretty much not true?
That's right. Today's settlement is for criminal penalties for the company. It does not include the $20 billion compensation fund BP set up after the spill, additional civil and private claims from Gulf states and businesses, or federal civil fines for violations of the Clean Water Act, which could go as high as $21 billion and will be determined in a New Orleans court next February. There's much more on this complex settlement and what's next at our website, greennews.bradblog.com.
That $4.5 billion agreement from BP, does that cut into their bottom line much?
No, actually, it's less than the $5.5 billion in profit BP made over the last 3 months.
I guess 11 counts of manslaughter was worth it.
Also notable, on Wednesday, in his first press conference since re-election, President Obama acknowledged the devastation caused by Superstorm Sandy. He also said the trend toward increasing extreme weather events means that he will take some kind of action on climate change.
You can expect that you'll hear more from me in the coming months and years about how we can shape an agenda that garners bipartisan support and helps move this agenda forward. This one's hard. But it's important. Based on the evidence we're seeing is that what we do now is going to have an impact and a cost down the road if we don't do something about it.
And how are environmentalists reacting to those remarks at his press conference?
It's pretty mixed. Some outlets criticize him for being less than vague, putting climate change way down the list behind tax negotiations, the economy, and job growth. A new poll shows, though, that now even more Americans are making the climate change connection with extreme weather. Right-leaning pollster Rasmussen released the results of a poll taken prior to the election showing that 68% of American voters believe global warming is either a very serious or a somewhat serious problem. In the meantime, NASA says October 2012 was the second warmest October for the planet. But the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration says it was only the fifth warmest on record. That's due to their different data sets. Both, however, agree that 2012 is on track to be the hottest year in history. Finally, California officially launched its landmark cap-and-trade emissions market on Wednesday with the auction of the first-ever carbon permits for greenhouse gas emissions by polluters in the state as part of its landmark global warming law signed by Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in 2006. Revenue will go into a greenhouse gas reduction account with funds to be used to promote clean energy and energy efficiency retrofits.
Blue California has a red governor sign a green bill. I'll take it. For more on all of the stories we covered today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to help sponsor the Green News Report. We rely on you to stay on your public airwaves. Also, remember, you can download anytime via iTunes, listen to us on your mobile device via Stitcher Radio, find us and like us on the Facebook, and follow us 24/7 on the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
California, I've been blue since I've been away from you. I can't wait till I get going. Even now, I'm starting to call. California, here I come. Right back where I started from. Where flowers, the flowers bloom in the spring.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
About 2 minutes past the hour on this Thorn in the Side Thursday on the Horn. Email coming in from Ron and Raleigh regarding the BP story as reported by Brad and Desi at the Green News Report. So, BP has agreed to plead guilty. Agreed to plead guilty, asks Ron. The hell does that mean? I'll tell you what it means. 11 people. Real people. Not corporate people. Are really dead. And none of these I want my life back sons of bitches are going to spend 1 second in jail. Two tears, Bob. Two tears, says Ron. T-I-E-R-S, tears. It makes me very sad and very angry. Indeed. And the punishment paid out by BP, as noted in the report, won't even be a blip on their financial report. Oh, it'll get referenced. It'll get referenced because they'll get to write it off on their taxes. Because of this penalty that they agreed to pay, they will actually, BP will actually pay less taxes. Just let that sink in, would you? I know I've said it before, so I'll say it again. The purpose of punitive damages in a civil suit is to punish the wrongdoer. This ain't much punishment. I wasn't surprised when the story broke, however, because I remember when the state of West Virginia allowed a coal company to pay a penalty in rocks. You know, they'd been found to have committed gross and flagrant violations of God knows how many regulations, and they were allowed to pay off in rocks. That they valued. Oh, these are very expensive rocks. Very expensive. I'd say that one right over there, it's probably a $1 million rock. Mm-hmm. And of course, government officials were there to say, yeah, by God, that does look like a $1 million rock. You know what? We're probably getting a bargain, so that might be $1.5 million. That might be a $2 million rock. No. The $2 million rock is right there behind it, the bigger one. Dang, that is a $2 million rock. See, that's the problem with corporate personhood. You know, if they want to be people, why? I only say this because there's a lot of talk back and forth. The Republican Party says that they want to solve our fiscal crisis by closing loopholes in the tax code. I got a loophole we can close. Since Citizens United says that corporations are people, let's eliminate the corporate tax rate. Let's eliminate the capital gains tax rate, and let's, hey, how about a flat tax? How about everybody pays the same rate that, say, oh, I don't know, a union pipe fitter pays? Everybody pays the same tax rate that a Walmart manager pays. Everybody pays the same tax rate that a legal secretary or a paralegal pays. Because they're all just people, right? Yeah, I don't think corporations would be up for closing them kind of loopholes, do you? Damn, it sure would be nice, though, wouldn't it? And while we're at it, what do you say we start talking about having a corporate death penalty? I mean, the right wing just goes bananas over death penalty. Right? Fry him, by God, stretch him out and crucify him horizontal like with that little plastic tube running into his arm. We want to watch him breathe his last. Let's have a corporate death penalty. Let's set it up so that if you're charged with, you know, killing 11 people for profit, then the death penalty can be imposed on the corporation. Now, we don't want the little silk-suited Wall Street boys to get all to get all up in arms, because we're not gonna horizontally crucify them. Though some may have done things that damned well earn it within the scope of present death penalty legislation. You know, malice aforethought, and, yeah, lying in wait. No, we're going to kill the corporation. It gets busted up. Its stock is sold on the steps of the courthouse. Its shareholders are divested of their value as a function of their complicity by being shareholders in the corporation. And it's sold off to whomever wants to take it over and try to do whatever it is the malfeasant corporation did and do it right, you know, without killing people. That's pretty out there, I know. Still kind of interesting to think about, don't you think? About 9 minutes past the hour. Phone number's 304-658-3333 if you want to get involved with the program. I did tell you that this is Thorn in the Side Thursday, and we do have some thorns in the side. Let's go down the educational road real quick. Dr. John sent this one in, and it didn't really, well, I wanted to save it for today. You remember when Dim Leader said, well, the real question is our children learning? What Dr. John sent in indicates that, well, they might be learning something, but it's the what part that gives you pause for reflection. After Dr. John sent this story in, I sent it to two people. I sent it to two professional educators. I sent it to Texas Betsy, and I sent it to Dr. Bill O'Brien. It's a story out of the Atlantic about a textbook. That textbook being an American history textbook. And we all know who sets the agenda for what gets taught in textbooks. That's right, Texas. Guess that's why they had to have a school book depository there back in 1963. In this case, it's a question of what are children taught about the last decade and a half? The story is by Connor Friedersdorf, What High School Taught Millennials About the War on Terrorism. Connor Friedersdorf writes, some time ago I got curious about what the high school kids are reading these days in history class. A quick consultation with a few teacher friends led me to The American Vision by Professors Joyce Appleby, Alan Brinkley, Albert Broussard, and James McPherson and Donald Ritchie. It's one of the most popular American history textbooks aimed at 11th grade students. As I understand it, the 2003 copy I hold in my hands would have been used in a typical classroom for 5 to 8 years. In other words, this is the American history book that shaped a lot of the young people who've recently joined the ranks of adult society, or at least eligible voters. Stand by, please. I just knew you didn't want to get sneezed on. So, Connor Friedersdorf started going through the textbook. He said, intent on feeling wiser if I was doomed to feel older, I decided to start there, there being the war on terrorism. How better to begin assessing the tome of history than by reading how its authors describe the major national events that I witnessed as an adult? Here, he says, is the first paragraph that I read. The terrorist attack on September 11th, 2001... This is the text from the textbook. This is, you know, children, you know, impressionable minds. The terrorist attack on September 11th, 2001 killed all 266 passengers and crew members on the four hijacked planes. Another 125 people died in the Pentagon. In New York City, nearly 3,000 people died. More Americans were killed in the attacks than died at Pearl Harbor or on D-Day in World War II. Oops. Mr. Friedersdorf notes that's a confusing way to compare the events for any student whose touchstone is Saving Private Ryan or Band of Brothers. It makes it seem as though 9/11 cost more lives than the invasion of Normandy. It's true that an estimated 2,499 Americans died on June 6, 1944 itself, a slightly lesser figure than the victims who died on September 11, 2001, but add up all Allied deaths on D-Day and the figure reaches 4,414 killed. Of course, all of them weren't Americans, and we all know that only Americans matter. American casualties were around 6,600 that day. Total Allied casualties were roughly 10,000. And over 425,000 Allied German and German troops were killed, wounded, or went missing from the Battle of Normandy. This figure includes over 209,000 Allied casualties, with nearly 37,000 dead amongst the ground forces and a further 16,714 deaths among the Allied air forces. Of the Allied casualties, 83,045 were from 21st Army Group, British, Canadian, and Polish ground forces, 125,847 from the U.S. ground forces. But that was just the tip of the iceberg. Mr. Friedersdorf notes, in the space of a few pages, it conveyed the mindset that got us from the rubble of the World Trade Center to Bush's invasion of Iraq, which wasn't a culprit. The textbook moves quickly from a description of 9/11 to a general definition of terrorism. Terrorism is the use of violence by non-governmental groups against civilians to achieve a political goal. Then on the very next page, a graphic called Major Terrorist Attacks Affecting Americans 1970 to 2001 labels the 1983 bombing of the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut and the 2000 bombing of the USS Cole terrorist attacks, although neither fit the definition the authors just offered. And then, by way of explaining the policy behind the war on terror, well, you get a little stenography. President Bush decided the time had come to end the threat of terrorism in the world. Really? Then there's the Patriot Act. Remember, we're talking about, between 2003 and 2008 to 2010, 11th graders. I was one of those once. I thought I was pretty hot stuff. I know now that I was probably right next door to being a moron. Not saying that young people are, but what's that song say? I'm so much older now, or whatever. I think it was the Birds. This is how it explains the Patriot Act. As part of his efforts to protect the American people from further terrorist attacks, President Bush created the Office of Homeland Security to coordinate the dozens of federal agencies working to prevent terrorism. He then appointed Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge to serve as the agency's director. The president also asked Congress to pass legislation to help the enforcement agencies track down terrorist suspects. Drafting the legislation took time. Congress had to balance Americans' Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable search and seizure with the need to increase security. President Bush signed the new anti-terrorist bill. God, this almost sounds like Fox movie tone news, doesn't it? President Bush signed the new anti-terrorist bill, known as the USA Patriot Act, into law in October 2001. The new law allowed secret searches to avoid tipping off suspects in terrorism cases. It also allowed authorities to obtain a single nationwide search warrant that could be used anywhere. The law also made it easier to wiretap suspects, and it allowed authorities to track email and seize voicemail. Time marches on. Holy crap. But we're not even into the fun part yet. Then it moves into the Iraq War. The terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001 showed that terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda were determined to kill as many Americans as possible. President Bush and his advisors were deeply worried that terrorist groups might acquire weapons of mass destruction. Weapons of mass destruction can kill tens of thousands of people all at once. During the Cold War, very few nations had weapons of mass destruction, and the United States relied on a policy of deterrence to prevent the use of such weapons. Under the deterrence policy, the United States vowed that if the nation used weapons of mass destruction against the U.S., the U.S. would counterattack by using its own weapons of mass destruction. Now, we're talking here about nuclear arms, but somehow or another they can't bring themselves to say nuclear weapons. But wait, there's more. In his State of the Union message to the American people in January 2002, President Bush warned that an axis of evil made up of Iran, Iraq, and North Korea posed a grave threat to the world. All three nations actively sponsored terrorism and were developing... This is offered as a statement of fact. All three nations actively sponsored terrorism and were developing weapons of mass destruction. All three. Iran, Iraq, North Korea. You know, that's true except for maybe the Iraq part and possibly the Iran part. You get the idea. I will not stand by as peril draws closer and closer, the president promised. The United States of America will not permit the world's most dangerous regimes to threaten us with the world's most dangerous weapons. Of the three nations in the axis of evil, President Bush and his advisors believed Iraq to be the most immediate threat. After the Gulf War ended in 1991, blah, 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 President Bush decided the time had come to deal with Iraq. Because, you know, he tried to kill my daddy. On September 12th, he asked the UN to pass a new resolution against Iraq, if Saddam Hussein wanted peace, he had to give up Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. So just imagine, you're an 11th grader in 2008. You read that. Makes it pretty clear, doesn't it? Saddam Hussein had to give up his weapons of mass destruction, which he definitely had. Let's see, how are you? You're 16 years old in 11th grade, right? What happens in 2018? What happens in 2028 when that 16-year-old is a 26-year-old or a 36-year-old? Well, hell yeah, Saddam had him some weapons of mass destruction. It was right there in my history book back in 2008 when I was an 11th grader. Ain't read no American history since. And then there's another section called Confronting Iraq. On January 28th, President Bush delivered his State of the Union address. God, I remember it. He warned that unless Saddam Hussein disarmed voluntarily, for the safety of our people and for the peace of the world, we will lead a coalition to disarm him. The United States did not want war, the president explained, but sometimes peace must be defended. A future lived at the mercy of terrible threats is no peace at all. And, you know, it's in the nature of parents to try to teach a little bit to their children. And so one of these days, the kid who was sitting in the classroom getting this in 2008 is going to look down at his little progeny and say, now, kids, listen up. We had a terrible war back in 2003. We had to go in and disarm Saddam Hussein and take away his weapons of mass destruction because we were defending our peace. Holy. Kind of makes you fear for the future, doesn't it? Well, here are the responses that I got. These are the responses that I got from Texas Betsy, professional educator. She said, Bob, this is terrible, but does it make you feel any better to know that nobody, not a single kid in this country, probably ever got to that part of the book? Well, maybe a little. And Dr. Bill told me, he said, Bob, this makes it clear that our teaching of history is a real mess in this country because the authors of this book are some of the most respected historians this country has. Holy mackerel. That's what you get from some of the most respected historians in the country? You know, Alan Brinkley, Joyce Appleby, Albert Broussard, James McPherson, Donald Ritchie. That's one of the most popular textbooks in America, too. And anybody want to wager on any of that having been corrected in subsequent editions? Because I won't bet that it was, because I don't want to lose the money. That's not history. That's indoctrination. That's not history. That's propaganda. That's disgusting. It's breathtakingly disgusting. That's outright lying. Those assertions that Mr. Connor Friedersdorf included in his article, those are not the product of reasonable debate. Those are not uncontrovertible facts. Whatever, you know, right-wingers, if you mention evolution to them, right-wingers holler, teach the controversy! Teach them about the gossipy water moccasin that caused Eve to eat the apple and screwed up all of creation. Teach the controversy! Where's teach the controversy in this? because this text creates the impression that the whole country just said, well, yeah, definitely got them. And what's worse, you know, as far as weapons of mass destruction are concerned, and what's worse, makes it appear that, yeah, he did, and he refused. So we had to, you know, murder Iraq. Yeah, it is somewhat soothing to realize that none of the students ever get to that page, that portion of the book, but I had this bad habit when I was a student, and I'll bet you there are still some students with this kind of bad habit. You go and do your homework, and you read the part you're supposed to read, but you're a book reader, and so you read ahead. Sometimes you go and look at other chapters just to see what might be coming up or what you might miss. And you get that. How in the, I mean, I know it probably doesn't exist, but how in the hell is that not historian malpractice? What happens when little Johnny from and little Susie from 2008, those 16-year-old 11th graders at the time, what happens when they are shaping the policy of the nation while we are either feeding worms or gumming our creamed corn? And they're looking for some sort of historical precedent to determine how this nation should go forward. What happens when they're the 60-year-olds who will still be running the country at that time? And they say, well, you know, we George Bush defended our peace by attacking somebody who hadn't attacked us. It's on! What does this say about how we understand history? What does this say about how we discuss current events? It says we've got a mess on our hands, pure and simple. Thorn in the side Thursday, indeed. I don't know. You want to move over into some differently horrifying stuff? The usual suspects, how about? You know, Radio Rwanda, Fox. It was over on Radio Rwanda that some footage was recently run of people crossing the arid and scrubby-ass desert of the American Southwest from Mexico into the United States. Well, I mean, that wasn't what the story about. It was just stock footage that somebody called up out of the video morgue there at Radio Rwanda Fox. See, that's the problem. The segment was actually called The Hispanic Vote in 2012. And the B-roll footage that they used, it is B-roll footage, I've got that term right, don't I? That they used was of brown people sneaking into America. There's your, and the implication, and the, you know, they've got it fonted, whatever, underneath, Chiron, I don't know. The Hispanic vote in 2012. Happening now, Fox News. Doesn't look like they're going to learn anything, does it? At least not the congressional for-profit media complex that likes to paint the issue this way. Because see, you know, if you're Fox News, you can't talk about the Hispanic vote by showing footage of, you know, people with Hispanic names going to work every day or picking up the kids at school or No, 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 no. They're all, if you've got a Hispanic last name, you are by God an illegal immigrant, and you got here by wandering across the arid, scrubby, the desert lands of the American Southwest. Jesus. But you got to give it to them. They stay on message. Because while Fox was airing that footage, a day before, Brian Fisher of the American Family Association of Tupelo, Mississippi, Stan, was out there talking to his listeners all across America, explaining to them what happened in that election where the blah man got reelected. That's reelected. You remember Brian Fisher. Brian Fisher is the guy who wants all the who says Jesus wants to kill all the grizzly bears. Because I guess they attack Christians or something. Right, yeah, really. I mean, if you actually live in a town where there's a radio station that runs this filth, you can tune in and it's like listening. I mean, if you didn't know better, it's like listening to somebody who is just lost in the depths of an acid trip from which you're pretty sure he's never coming back. Really. Here's the courtesy of our friends at Right Wing Watch. Here's Brian Fisher.
Hispanics are not Democrats, don't vote Democrat, because of immigration. That's not the main reason why they vote for Democrats. It doesn't have anything to do with lax immigration policy. It has to do with the fact that they are socialists by nature. They come from Mexico, which is...
Wait. First of all, I want to back up just a second. Let's just go to the whole clip all over again. Pay very close attention. Because I don't know, I think brother pastor, broadcaster, Brian Fisher's done been into the communion line. There's a little slurring going on.
Hispanics are not Democrats, don't vote Democrat, because of immigration. That's not the main reason why they vote for Democrats. It doesn't have anything to do with lax immigration policy. It has to...
Policy? Either that or his dentures are slipping. Lax immigration policy.
Doesn't have anything to do with lax immigration policy. It has to do with the fact that they are socialists by nature. They come from Mexico, which is a socialist country.
You got that? Jot that down. Because there are some a priori assumptions inside the statements being made by God's own broadcaster, Brian Fisher. First of all Hispanics come from Mexico. I don't know if he prayed Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, Costa Rica, Panama, and the rest and South America away, or if they just fell off his map, or if he's just got them all relabeled as future home of the Confederate States of America, or I don't know. But all Hispanics come from Mexico, and all Hispanics are socialists. Yeah, we all remember October 1917. When the Bolshevik Revolution, led by Lenin and Trotsky, washed up... Well, wait, that was Russia. I mean, well, they did come over to Mexico to kill Trotsky later, but that was a couple of decades later. And you wonder why textbooks wind up with statements in them saying that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Good God. Now, what Brian Fisher means when he says that all Mexicans are socialists is that all Mexicans hate America. And, of course, they're prone to throwing Molotov cocktails and, you know, want to tear down America and get it right. You know what? Cuba did go communist in its revolution. And I don't remember Mexico signing on and saying, us too! Reckon Brian Fisher's ever even been to Mexico? It's one of my dreams, another one of those dreams that'll probably never come true now. But Lord, I've wanted to go to Mexico. Oh, how I'd love to see the pyramids. The museum, the National Museum there in Mexico City. I got a pitch in one of my emails the other day for a hotel in Mexico City. 17-room hotel that is housed in a 16th century palace that was inhabited originally by Mexica nobility. It's still there. Man. But I'm guessing Brian Fisher's never been to Mexico because he thinks that there's just one group of people in Mexico called Mexicans. It's almost enough to make you want to send him a copy of Jeff Biggers' In the Sierra Madre. But I'm guessing that Brian Fisher has never gotten real proficient at the art of reading words. All kinds of people, all kinds of indigenous groups, all kinds of tribal peoples, all over Mexico. The old remnants of the Chichimeca and the Mexicatl to the north and central, and the Maya peoples to the south. And then there's Guatemala and Honduras, El Salvador, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Panama. I missed Nicaragua the last time. Sorry, guys. They just don't exist. They're just all Mexican socialists.
They want big government intervention. They want big government goodies. It's primarily about that. Now they
goodies. You know, candy, chewing gum, and little Jim Crack jewelry and stuff you find in a Cracker Jack box. Oh, the Cracker Jacks. They want goodies. I mean, they don't want to earn a living or feed their children. NAFTA had nothing to do with driving campesinos off their land and forcing them into the arms and tender mercies of the free market and globalization and drive them as if herded northward across the border to work for $2.75 an hour swabbing toilets. Oh, hell no, none of that happened. Meanwhile, the United States, in large part because of the manifest racism and hatred and just bilious, vile, racist disgust manifested by the white wingers for persons of brown skin, has reached something approaching zero growth in terms of the undocumented immigrant population. Hell, they wrecked the economy. The white wingers wrecked the economy so damn good that nobody can come here and work anymore. Talk about being between the devil and the deep blue sea. You get forced off your land at home that you've only been on for the last 15 or 20,000 years. And you're forced northward through a gauntlet of guerrilla warfare occasioned by the anti-drug policies of the United States. There ain't no work. What's a fella to do? They want goodies. Hell's bells. Undocumented immigrants come here. They can't even get so much as a driver's license. They can't get auto insurance. In places like Alabamistan, they cannot purchase electricity. They can't get a library card. But they're coming here for goodies. You know, Twinkies and Ding Dongs. Oh, shit, the Twinkie factories are closing. They come here to spend glorious socialist days standing on a hog slaughter line for 8 hours, hacking with razor-sharp knives through hogs on an assembly line that processes 32,000 hogs a day. Tar Heel, North Carolina, Smithfield needs. Because they want goodies. Children labor in the hot southwestern or Florida sun, picking lettuce, picking tomatoes, picking grapes. Children who will be bent double before their 20th birthday because they want goodies. And remember, this man's a Christian. Ain't that nice? Ain't that special?
They want open borders, make no mistake, because they've got family and friends that they want to come up and be able to benefit from the plunder of the wealth of the United States. Just
plundering the wealth of the... Yar! Show me the booty. Plundering the wealth of the United States. $2.75 an hour at a time. No workers' comp. No Social Security. No social safety net. No emergency rooms. No medical care. Just bring that little icon of the Virgin of Guadalupe with you and hope for the effing best. Because they want to plunder America's wealth. And by God, they'll be on poor Willard Romney's door asking to mow his lawn next thing you know. And they'll be wanting to be paid money for it. I mean, there's probably some socialist Mexican out there right now who wants to be the elevator operator for Willard's car elevator. Because they want to plunder the wealth of America.
As they have been able to do. Republicans can pander all they want to Hispanics, to immigrants, and it will not work. There is...
So... I mean, if there's a bright side to any of this, is that they ain't learning. I mean, yeah, the day after the election, the news was full of talk about how the great brown hope of the Republican Party was either Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, or Susana Martinez. But it ain't like the people who control the Republican Party, people like Brian Fisher, want anything to do with it. Because if you talk about Hispanic people, you know, the Mexican socialists, God, I remember when David in Tennessee told me the story about listening to Michael Savage one night when he explained that, what was it, Mexicans are communist. Because, no, Mexicans were Nazis because they play the accordion in their music, and accordions came from Nazi Germany. Ergo, yeah, Mexican Nazi accordion music. But now we find out they're socialists. I wish they'd get their politics all squared away. What? And by the way, if the Mexican Nazis are playing accordions, what the are the Mexican socialists playing? Is that I don't know. Is that those great big guitars? You know, those socialist guitars? I mean, I guess there's some fear out there that the Republicans might wise up and realize, nah, ain't gonna, couldn't possibly happen. Not as long as Brian Fisher is out there to warn his mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking listeners that Mexican socialists are coming to plunder America.
Republicans can pander all they want to Hispanics, to immigrants, and it will not work. There is no way on earth you're going to get them to leave.
Did you get that? Wait a minute.
Republicans can pander all they want to Hispanics, to immigrants, and it will not work. There is no way on earth you're going to get them to leave.
This is one of those moments where wherever the tired old bones or whatever remains of the ashes of poor old Aristotle are, They're having a true blue purple polka dotted conniption and a hissy and kittens with crocheted tails all rolled into one. Immigrants, Hispanics. I mean, this is another one of those moments where if you got Brian Fisher all good and liquored up, or handed him a little bit of the brown acid or something, pretty soon you could probably get him to. Get him to declare that Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz aren't really Americans. They're probably Mexican socialists, too, hiding out in a Republican sleeper cell until they're called to wakefulness and come to plunder white America's wealth. In that weird little corner of America. And I don't know if he's in Tupelo, Mississippi, or Washington, D.C., or the Keokuk, Iowa, or Kokomo, Indiana. But whatever weird little corner of white America Brian Fisher is in, he doesn't realize that most of the people he's hating on were here first. I mean, Brian Fisher, even if you can trace your genealogy back to the damn Mayflower or the Jamestown colony, they were still here first. There were people with Hispanic names who were citizens of the United States in the 13 original colonies. Lord knows that when American borders were imposed upon the Southwest, people became American overnight. And it never really mattered much. Chop wood, carry water. Doesn't matter if you're doing that as a Mexican or an American. Or as a Chichimeca. Or a Rarimuri or a Mexica. You get the idea. But when Brian Fisher looks out at America, he sees a beleaguered, besieged band of noble Christian white people holding off the barbarian hordes of socialist Mexicans who want goodies. And every last one of them is an illegal immigrant, just like Fox News Radio Rwanda done showed on the TV box.
And it will not work. There is no way on earth you're going to get them to leave the Democratic Party. It's one of the reasons why we got to clamp down on immigration.
Thanks, Right Wing Watch. That's why we got to clamp down on immigration. Because if we can just build a 9-mile-high fence that runs along the Rio Grande and all along the Mexican, New Mexican and Arizona and California borders, well, then we can stop this, and white people can control everything again. You know, like Jesus wants. Inherent in all this is the idea that the election itself was tainted by the votes of undocumented immigrants. Imagine that. There's a future coming for Mr. Fisher. There's a tide coming in, and he can stand on the shore and scream at it until he is whiter in the face than he already is. But that tide's coming. And it's okay. Because we're talking about people who simply want to raise their children, feed them every day, love them, help them be decent citizens. Just as virtually everyone who has ever come to this country has sought. Because that is the American dream. The same thing I was talking about with ending mountaintop removal. The joy inherent in new parents watching the peaceful, easy, restful sleep of a newborn. The American dream isn't fireworks on the 4th of July or being able to get filthy, stinking rich. It's being able to look down at that newborn and not hate yourself for bringing another life into an intolerable world. To being able to hope that maybe that child will be the one that does some great thing when that great thing is merely a matter of carrying on the family name and doing as right by her family when her time comes as her mama and daddy did for her. That's the American dream. And it knows no skin color. And it knows no language. And it knows no border. Dumbasses don't understand that America was named America long before there was a political subdivision called the colonies or the United States. America was actually the name of South America first. But they won't learn. They can't learn. And we're going to have to put up with a lot of hatefulness and a lot of ignorance and a lot of vitriol. A lot of bile. And they must be constantly opposed. But in opposing them, we can also recognize that these are the death squalls of a great thrashing beast out in the middle of the tar pit, and that soon there will be nothing left of them but their remains, which perhaps future historians might ponder. Andy writing in says, Bob, I love the way Brian Fisher emphasizes the rat in Democrat when he should use the adjective democratic. That goes all the way back, of course, to Dr. Newton Leroy Gingrich, amateur paleontologist. Andy says, I hate when these pigs do that. I'm no big fan of the Democratic Party, but do these representatives of the religion industry have to keep saying Democrat? Well, yeah, they do, Andy. You're lucky they're not calling us Demoncrats. I've heard that, too. Yeah, we want the goodies. The goodies, Andy says, we paid for, or will pay for. And because we all together decided to buy those goodies, we're all in as a country. Collectively, the goodies are more efficient, cost-effective, providing the greatest economies of scale, negotiating power, along with the full faith and credit of the guaranteed by the USA. My father, says Andy, always believed Social Security was the best program ever devised by our terribly flawed government. The religion industry hates the people working together for the common good in a secular manner. They can't stand it because it, and this is the point, because it makes them irrelevant. Ron writing in says, hey Bob, I may be wrong, but I don't believe these right-wing horses' asses have any idea what socialism even means. This is a meme that has been taken up all over the wingnutosphere. If they believe Barack Obama is a socialist, then I'm a bomb-throwing Trotskyite. If Mexico was a socialist country, the government there would take better care of them so they wouldn't have to run across the border to survive. P.S. If they play harps in heaven, then they must play accordions in hell. Old joke. I'll bet you as soon as the internet latency catches up and Bill hears that in Cleveland, he's laughing. By the way, on the history story a little bit ago, Randy in PA wrote in, he said, and the indoctrination continues in college. I took college courses in modern history, specifically Russian history, and the professor lectured about Stalin's massacres and specifically about the millions who were forced to starve in Russia in the early portion of the 20th century and the murders of the Tsar and his immediate family. Now, take a professor whose presentation was extremely dry and try to impress a bunch of 20-year-olds about the horror of mass murder. Doesn't really work. Now, I'm not arguing that Stalin was better than Hitler. He wasn't. Could arguably have been worse. But curiously, there was no corresponding course offered on German history. It was only years later that I realized that this was a form of partial indoctrination. You must be carefully taught. Right? So here we are at the end of the second hour. Listen, if we're going to have some conversation radio, y'all going to have to get with it. 304-658-3333. And on Skype, Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, Horn, Bob Kincaid, Horn. And that gets you right through. Either way is fine. All calls will be taken as long as they're not coming in 2 minutes or 5 minutes before the program ends. That makes it a little bit different. And difficult. There we go. This is America's listener-supported home of conversation radio. Liberal, progressive in nature. PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. We've had a couple of kind contributions this evening. We've still got about $90 to go to draw even with the 15th of the month. PayPal works. So does the snail mail address. Either way is fine. That's how we keep all this going. And what this is the horn.
Where's my pal? Where's my friend? All good things must have an end. Sad things and nothings, on and on they go. I guess he went to Mexico. They all went to Mexico. When Diaz got to go. Tango K.O. better send me Carter's song. They all went to Mexico. Where's my sweetie? Where's the face? I lit dark corners every place. She put up with me a long time, you know. And then she had to go to Mexico. They all went to Mexico. When Diaz got to go. Tango Kilo better send me caught a song. Thank you. Mexico. Where's my love and where's my grace? Has it all been just a foolish chase? Every time I hear that rainy chill wind blow, I think it might be time to head to Mexico. They all went to Mexico when the got to go. Tengo que obed a ser mi corazón.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Bob.
Yeah, and we'll try to get the toll-free number taken care of as soon as that becomes financially possible. And I work out the hostage negotiations with CityNet. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. Thorn in the Side Thursday, Conversation Radio, about to finally get underway. A quick email coming in from Michael, and the email is Conversation Radio, too. I wanted to get this out there early on because this is quite perceptive. That history textbook story, Bob, is pretty much the 1984 memory hole manifested. Not only will these pupils be misinformed about the Bush era if they read this part, but if little Timmy happens to figure out the truth of the matter and is asked or tested in class, his factual account will land him an F. No, that is wrong, Timmy. Bush had to invade Iraq because of their weapons of mass destruction. Then, when little Timmy grows up and starts following the news, he will think sources that put the news into a correct historical perspective are highly political biased. Liberals! Liberal bias! Right. While Fox News, Radio Rwanda, will seem like a bastion of reputability for using the false narrative. It's like a little peek behind the curtains in the Wizard's Hall, isn't it? Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey. Good afternoon, Bob.
Hey, what's happening, Kevin?
Not much, actually. Hey, what group is that Brian Fisher with?
The American Family Association of Tupelo, Mazlipistan.
Yeah, that's what I thought. You know, I want to say a couple things. I am a democratic socialist. There's just no further doubt in my mind after listening to that piece of garbage and what he had to say about Hispanics that I can't claim capitalism, don't want to claim it, don't want anything to do with it. Because if that's capitalism, much less Christianity, I can't claim it.
I understand, but do you notice, Kevin, how they the message discipline that these weirdos have? I mean, there's Brian Fisher saying it. And there's Fox News Radio Rwanda showing people crossing the border in a story about the Hispanic vote in 2012. And all of this is riffing off of the king talking point, if you will, that Bishop Willard Romney has recently put out there, that he could have beaten Barack Obama, but Barack Obama gave those people too many gifts.
Yeah, well, I'll claim those gifts, too, because that's...
I'm still waiting for mine.
Well, that Social Security disability insurance that I get. If you want to call that a gift, you're free to do so.
But you had you
for that
before the things that befell you took you from the workforce. You worked, right?
Exactly.
And you had a pretty long and productive work life, I'll warrant.
Right.
And you paid into the system, didn't you?
Yep,
and you paid your taxes.
Yep.
Well, that ain't no gift. You worked your rear end off every day, so you don't have to starve now.
If Brian Fisher wants to convince his flock that it's a gift, go right ahead and believe that, people, because you've got a rude awakening coming if America ever does fall for people like this, because...
Kevin, what do you mean, if America ever does? This guy goes out to hundreds of radio stations every day. There are people sitting in their homes and driving in their cars and praying in the pews going, yes, amen, glory, hallelujah, testify, preach it, Brother Brian, amen and amen.
Sure, but at least there's still, 3 million plus of us, more of us, that... don't believe it, then...
Right, and growing every day, but that doesn't stop that doesn't stop it from being successful in Mississippi, Stan. It's a great message in Alabama, Stan, Georgia, Stan, Tennessee, Stan, Arkansas, Stan, Oklahoma, Stan.
Even if they believe this stuff, they still can get their Social Security disability or Social Security or Medicaid or food stamps.
Well, guess who's listening to him?
Huh?
Guess who's listening to him?
Right.
I mean, he doesn't put that broadcast out there for the 1%. The 1% are off at their lobster lunches and croquet outings at the club.
Right. But what I'm saying is if they truly believed in Bob, they'd refuse all that good, those gifts. And I want to see him do that. You really believe what he's selling here, people? Then you sign a piece of paper saying that you don't claim any of it, never, and find out when you're still working at 80 just so you can survive, and we'll see what you think of it then. But I
know it almost takes your ability to work with words away, doesn't it, Kevin?
Oh yeah, because it's irrational. It's just like that textbook. Actually, I was beginning to think that it was written by Fox.
What blew my doors off when Dr. Bill wrote back and said those historians are among the most respected in this country.
I know, but I have to wonder what their political affiliation is, not that you as an historian documenting facts should even let political affiliation...
Well, but bear in mind, who drives the textbook industry in this country?
Texas.
Right. So dim leader. Well, some Texans refuse to claim him and consider him a Connecticut Yankee interloper. But he came from Midlands or wherever. And the fact of the matter is, the Texas School Book Commission has a big say so in what those things contain.
Exactly.
We get ourselves head up over things like evolution and natural selection and biology, and the creationism that they keep wanting to use to indoctrinate and poison the minds of our children. But the fact of the matter is, they do it in every subject. If they could put a little picture of Jesus over the equals sign in a mathematics textbook, it would be the miracle equals sign, and Texas would demand that the rest of the country acknowledge a miracle when 2 and 2 make 4.
Yep.
Sorry, not barking at you. This drives me crazy.
Well, it should. It should drive even Christians crazy. And there is a difference. I've come to believe that there is a big difference between someone like Jude up in Seattle and someone like this Brian Fisher guy.
Oh, and well, no. I mean, Jude. Jude keeps me sane by sending me alerts about these Dominionist horses' rear ends. No. I don't know. You may be thinking about somebody else, but...
That's what I'm thinking of, and that's what I'm saying. The difference being is that she lives it, he preaches it.
Yeah, I've never known Jude to be a Christian, but maybe I'm wrong.
But
I understand. But I do understand your point, Kevin, and it's a point very well made. Now that the phones are lit up, I'm going to move along. But I'm glad you called in, and all I can say is all we can do is shine a light on this stuff and hope that the cockroaches scurry, right?
Well, I think that what we need to do is start holding our leaders accountable and holding people like this Brian Fisher accountable. Not that it'll be done by the by this Congress or by this president, but the way they violated the tax laws by openly supporting Romney, I'd love to see every one of them that did it have their tax exempt status pulled from them, and I guarantee you it would stop in a minute because the money is more important to them.
Well, that's why we call it an industry, Kevin.
Exactly. I call it the religio, military, industrial complex. And I can add a few more things in there, too, but you think about it today, Bob. Religion and military are the two biggest things driving these.
Well, and if you go over and look at the work that Mikey Weinstein has done at the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, you'll note that the religion industry is deeply co-opted, or deeply embedded inside the American military. I mean, remember the Jesus rifles that are in Afghanistan, even as we speak, with little Bible verses about converting the heathens.
Oh, yeah. We're going to convert the heathens while we shoot them at the same time.
Right.
doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but oh, well. So, anyway, I'll let you go so you can get some other people in here. I just wanted to comment on it, and really I want to make a statement of just fact, and for me, is that I can't claim these so-called Christian people. And I can no longer claim to be I was never a pure capitalist anyway, but that capitalism they taught us when we were in school and how you're...
Yeah, it doesn't quite work out the same way, does it?
Oh, No.
Well, Kevin, have a good evening, my friend.
You too, Bob.
Bye now.
Bye.
Kevin, calling from Colorado Springs. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob, I think you've got Hit Dave here on the West Coast.
Well, hey, Dave, what's happening?
I've been trying to call you for a couple of hours on two different phones and getting all kinds of, for the most part, busies.
The toll-free number ain't working right now. It's being held hostage.
Yeah, I think it is, and I'm very suspicious as to why.
No, it's being held. No. There's nothing to be suspicious about, Dave. It's being held hostage over a bill.
I see. Okay, and if the bill gets paid, then they'll turn.
Well, no. If we pay them. It's not about the bill for the toll-free service. It's about a bill for services they never rendered. And I'm not going to pay for something we didn't buy.
No, I can relate to that. I find that, I am a terribly suspicious person because I have had years of dealing with high-tech folks that can invade our computers, our phones, and I don't find the high level of character that some of us would like to think that is there in our government. There are those who have, it began maybe, there was a side to J. Edgar Hoover that might have been a crime fighter, but for the most part it's how do we get the goods on those people that we need to keep in check, keep silent, that we don't want to have them spilling their guts, calling radio talk shows, writing letters to the editors and whatnot. They monitor those kind of people. I don't know. Maybe if somebody said they were going to try to sell some nuclear armament to a Chinese Navy or something, they might get interested in that, too. But for sure, I can attest that they are very much interested in those people who blow the whistle and expose corporate and government fraud. I'm one that does it, and I'm one that enjoys the the results. You don't even have to comment on it. You don't need the problems that I enjoy from them, but you're hearing one man's opinion.
Well, we say hi to Agent Fred over in the bowels of the NSA every night, sitting there by the Unablab 10,000. Hi, Agent Fred.
That's good. Hi.
Fred spells his name P-H-R-E-D, by the way.
P.B. Collins used to talk to his goon who was in a white van down the street there, but...
The Internet's wonderful. You don't even have to have the white triangulating van anymore. Cuts down on travel costs. It's good for the deficit.
My latest critical thinking involves this election. As best I was able to follow what was happening, it was very much the plan, the intent of the neocons to zap into the machines and flip enough votes to put Mitt and his folks in power, in office. And this time we had some international observers, some of them United Nations, and apparently some of them were real smart about the electronic technology and caught some of these tech goons doing their things, and they were kind of, they responded with, so what, go away, don't do it, but they apparently had some power that they weren't ready for, so these hackers suddenly had to back out, and not do it. They hadn't finished the job, so that's when I guess Obama suddenly started doing real well, and it picked up, and he had won by several 100,000 more votes than will be shown, but he won by enough to have a pretty good win. So, and of course that's not the total solution, because he too has to play ball and salute to the powers that be that say, here's the money, now do what we tell you, you know, and they have but to remind him that JFK once thought that it was all right for a president to think for himself and do his own thing, and that I think that that's possible. I don't have any verification.
Well, there was a lot of the good old-fashioned dirt going on, too. The fact that there were 600,000 ballots simply left uncounted in Arizona, all the provisional ballot shenanigans in places like Ohio and North Carolina and Virginia, the Korean people, the elderly Korean people in Northern Virginia who were forced to form a separate line and demonstrate proficiency in English before they could vote. You don't need any high-tech stuff necessarily. Voter suppression is plenty, but the problem was people were unwilling to have their votes suppressed, and so they stood in lines for 6 and 8 hours to exercise the franchise, and that's what made the difference.
We all saw that, and for the most part, what we saw were minorities, lower income, poor, black folks and whatnot that were standing in line. And that
That Brian Fisher has declared that the clip I played, Brian Fisher has declared that every single person of Hispanic origin in the United States is an illegal immigrant.
Well, then I'm not being paranoid to be a bit suspicious that our elections aren't as pure and above board as we might like to hope.
No, as long as there are Republicans, there will be voter suppression. It's that simple, Dave. I mean, because Republicans could not, in any given district or precinct, Republicans could not win an election for dog catcher without keeping people home. There simply aren't enough of them to do any good.
Yeah, and then there is a hell of a lot, and you pointed it out, of people that do want so much to believe that they sit in front of their TV and turn on the Fox channel, and they are told how they are clearly the good guys on the right side of this fair and balanced system that they're, and they're so proud that they know truth, that others don't. There's a faction there that does exist. I understand it's diminishing. It's nowhere near as big as they'd like to believe, but there is a significant number of people that are thinking that how happy they are to be getting this fair and balanced truth, and there that exists.
Well, it's, you know, Fox doesn't exist to deliver the news. Fox exists to confirm prejudices to assure people that their bigotries are the right ones and that all the problems America has are the fault of the other. Plain and simple.
As a fact, those people sitting there are never going to get to hear the realities of what goes on elections. And it was there that we saw their guy, Karl Rove, like, oh, no, just a minute, you stand by, you wait, this is not really happening. Our guy is about to turn it around.
Right, we're getting ready to throw the third switch. Right.
Yeah. And he couldn't comprehend that his tech goons had gotten caught and kicked off the precinct. So, and I think that's clearly what happened. They fully intended to stick us with Mitt Romney this time. And he himself had no question. It was, you know, that some people say, well, that was because he believes he's been ordained, that by divine power he is chosen to be the...
Oh, right. He's the white horse of Mormon prophecy. Exactly. But that's another thing. You know, America has learned some of us did, learned a whole lot more about Mormonism than we ever wanted to know. And so the next time one of them tries it, you know, we'll be able to say, no white horses for you. Sorry. Mm-mm, forget it. Hey, Dave, it's awful good to hear from you, my friend. And rest assured, the problems here have nothing to do with anyone trying to suppress the horn. As is often the case, the problem here is strictly money. So thanks a lot, and have yourself a good evening, Dave.
You too, Bob.
All right.
And those are getting different reactions, different recordings. But we keep trying.
All right. Bye now. Dave calling from California. Tracy is with us on Skype. Hey, Tracy.
Hey, Bob. How the hell are you?
Oh, I'm just dandy.
You know, I don't know where to start. Do we start with the craziness of Petraeus and his women? And
I am earnestly. I talked a little bit about that the other evening, and I'm trying to. It's just so tawdry, and it's so 10th grade. It turns out that everybody involved with this is tawdry in some way or another.
Are these the people? And have you noticed that all these people are Republicans on this?
Oh, sure. You know, and Petraeus even had to come out into the for-profit media today and poke his head up into the sunshine and say, listen, none of this had anything to do with Benghazi. Had everything to do with me being a horny, just a horny little general.
After that Benghazi. So I heard that our boy McCain was on the television too today talking about how our president is still a cover-up.
McCain has gone from yelling at clouds and screaming, get off my lawn. Now he's screaming at reporters saying, I didn't show up for that briefing because I'm a senator and I don't have to if I don't want to and you can't make me. Who the hell are you to ask me any questions? I mean, he's just gone.
He is. I find it sad because he started off with, I don't know what happened. Was it the election of 2008 and picking up Sarah Palin that he just gave up and stopped being human, or he just was totally, I don't know.
No, he's been a punk all his life.
Oh, he's
never. He's never earned an honest dollar in his entire existence. For all that the Republicans like to talk about so-called welfare queens and whatnot, John McCain has sucked at the federal teat since the day he emerged from his mother's womb. He was born on the federal dime. He was raised on the federal dime. He went to school on the federal dime. And he's done nothing, but...
And what tickles me, like, everybody's been screaming, you know, these birthers about our president, but wasn't he born in Panama?
Yes, he was. And he wasn't even born in the Canal Zone. He was born in the territorial confines of the state, of the nation of Panama. But there's so many things about McCain. You know, he's probably the worst pilot, even worse than George H.W. Bush. Worst pilot that the Navy has ever produced. It just goes on and on and on. But he insists on being treated like some sort of great statesman, because otherwise, you know, he's just a member of David from Maine's member of the I Got Nothing Institute.
I got nothing.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm noticing about a lot of what's happening after the week after the election. And they're still trying to say the reason why our president won is because of the brown, you know, ugly. I'm still waiting for the gifts. Where my gifts at? I'm black, so where my gifts at?
Yeah, I mean, you'd at least have gotten an Obama phone by now.
You know, a button, a pen, you know, student loan forgiveness.
Secret liberal agenda decoder ring and certificate suitable for framing?
Yeah. Speaking of that, I just made my reservations for Netroots Nation.
Did you really?
Yes, I did. Well, I did make my hotel reservations, so in January I'll register. And I just want, tell me more, let's just talk about fun stuff. So tell me about Netroots Nations, because I've been wanting to go and do it.
Oh, it's awesome. It's 2 or 3 days of just amazing progressive panels. And they always bring in a lineup of really, really awesome speakers. There's a room of exhibitors on just about every progressive cause you could possibly imagine. People of goodwill all over the place. And it's just nice. It's nice to be in a convention hall full of people who think like you do.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, people who want universal single-payer health care, people who... people who want to breathe clean air and bathe in
clean water
and drink clean water, and people who don't want to wreck the planet, people who want to see solar panels and wind turbines, and people who want clean and fair elections and transparent government. I mean, it's nice. I don't know how in the world we'll be able to raise the money to get out there, but I sure would love to.
Well, we're going to have to figure that out, because I will go. Because it's what, 200? It is kind of pricey. $295. Actually, that's not bad. Would you have to pay $295, or what would you have to pay?
When we've gone out in the past, we've gone out as exhibitors.
Okay. Cool.
We were actually speakers on a panel.
And how much would you guys have to, so you basically at this point would have to raise?
Oh, we'd have to get out there and get the hotel rooms and eat and live while we're there.
Well, the good news is if you have to, you can always stay in my room.
Yeah, but it's in San Jose. That's a hell of a commute from L.A., isn't it?
Oh, no. Actually, because I was going to drive, and it's about a 5-hour drive. It's not that bad. It is not. I mean, it's maybe closer to 4-hour drive. It is not a bad drive at all, and I would just stay the whole weekend.
Right.
Or I would fly up. I haven't decided what I'm going to do, if I can get a good flight, but I am going to go, because how can I not, seeing that it's in, you know, on the West Coast? I would be.
Yeah, they've never done one on the West Coast before, so this is a big deal.
And aren't they? Which tickles me, since they're located. Aren't their headquarters in San Francisco?
Yeah.
And and they've never done one on the West Coast. So
I got to share this with you. David in South Carolina just wrote in and said, as far as gifts are concerned, by the way, a $77,000 a year tax credit for a dancing horse is a big gift from the U.S. government. Paying no federal income tax on millions of dollars of income earned in foreign countries is another big gift courtesy of the USA government.
Right.
So I guess Bishop Willard knows a little bit about getting gifts from the Obama administration.
Right. And see, this is what tickles me about the gifts, because it's like the average American, we don't get gifts. Like you said, these people are, you know, getting not paying any income, I mean taxes on any of their income. Like I found out the other day, I love the fact about how Walmart doesn't pay, we pay the sales tax to them, but they don't pay the sales tax to the state.
No, because they get a rebate.
Uh-huh. And then you have the oil companies. How much did they make in profit? And they're still getting subsidies?
Mm-hmm.
So when you're talking about gifts, I have to say what you're talking about, Willis, because if they think that the only reason why our president won was because of these gifts, nobody, because I don't remember him saying in any speeches that we were going to get gifts. Do you?
No. No. No,
I'm just making sure that I didn't miss that.
But the thing is, you know, Willard didn't just say gifts. Willard elaborated on it. Willard considers being able to go to the doctor when you're sick a gift. Willard considers that if you're 24 years old and you get to stay on your parents' health insurance policy till you're 26 and out there in the real workforce as a gift, that's a gift. Because why? Because he had some sort of private for-profit health insurance. Or none at all, and just paid cash. when Ann pulled up lame?
Well, if he's there, he's going to have to shoot her.
See, I wouldn't even say that.
They shoot horses, don't they?
Seen the movie.
But see, that's what I, because it's like, and I laugh at like Paul Ryan and all of them about, you know, yelling about pensions and health care.
Oh, and I mean, you had to have just had a fit when you saw Paul Ryan's comment about why. See, Willard said they lost because of the gifts. Paul Ryan said they lost because we never imagined there would be that many urban voters, you know, blah voters. You got to love them. I mean, like I said, they're not going to learn, Tracy.
Which is fine. Which is absolutely fine because they don't get it. They don't want to get it. It's like you saw the movie Boys in the Hood, yes?
Oh, yeah. Have you,
and what is the Ice Cube says? He's like, either they don't know or they don't care for what's going on in the rest of the United States.
Well, no, it's like Brian Fisher. There's an America out there that is absolutely invisible to him. Unless he sees him sneaking across the border.
Or cleaning his house, or taking care of his kids.
Right.
See, those, they can come here. The ones that are, you know. And that's what troubles me about the whole thing. It's like, I'm happy, you know, that the president won, and, you know, we pretty much kicked butt on everything. But the problem is, and thank God that there is becoming more of us than them, but they're still them. And you still, like you have, like you were talking about the textbooks in Texas. What do they call, I forgot what they call slavery, something about the Atlantic trades, the triangle.
Oh, right, yeah,
You know, and that's where we have to start, because here's my problem. How is it that you can print textbooks for an entire state and none of it be factual?
Because you've got a textbook commission that is decidedly opposed to facts.
I don't understand that. I just don't understand how you can
the Texas Textbook Commission, for instance, replaced Thomas Jefferson with Phyllis Schlafly and got rid of Cesar Chavez altogether?
Did they let Martin Luther King stay?
I seem to recall him getting severely edited.
Ooh, Lord.
You know, passages on the miracle of free market, free market conservative capitalism.
Oh, God.
And I swear, I'm not kidding, one of these days they're going to insist that we put a little picture of Jesus over the equal sign in math books.
Well, see, I had no idea about the guns because you just mentioned it. With the guns with Jesus on them in Afghanistan? Are you serious?
Oh, yeah. The company is Trigicon. And they put little abbreviations of Bible verses into the serial number so that when they go to killing Afghans, they will do so in the name of Christ Jesus.
Holy Christ. Oh, my God. It's like I said, amazing.
Oh, they got caught doing that several years ago, and the Pentagon told them to stop it, and the defense contractor said, screw you, and just kept on doing it.
And they didn't pull their contract, obviously.
Oh, no. Wouldn't want to get Jesus mad at the Army.
You know, because he is on our side. Well, ask how you know, what...
He did say, pick up thy Uzi and follow me.
Well, there, you know, we're still talking about what happened with the Crusades. I mean, it was all about Jesus, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we've been warring with the Middle East since the Crusades, and they still haven't learned. We can't win.
Well, you know, there was a respite there. I mean, in American history, yeah, we had a little dust-up with the Barbary Pirates, but that was not a religious war. That was a war with a bunch of thugs. And in fact, when we sat down and signed the treaty that ended it, the language of that treaty states, and this is pretty near a quote, the United States acknowledges that the United States is in no wise founded upon the Christian religion.
Hello. It's like, I keep
but,
going
you know,
over
try to explain
head.
That to David Barton over at Wall Builders, or Glenn Beck, or, you know, Brian Fisher. You know, he'll probably send a grizzly bear after you.
Well, Well, remember what was that Schoolhouse Rock? I still remember it. We the people, in order to form a most perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and what's the rest? Because I don't want to sing. Because that's how I.
Oh, sing, Tracy, sing.
No, but I just remember at the end to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
Right.
No God in there. And that's the problem. It's about the education, because I still remember that from Schoolhouse Rock over 30 years ago.
Well, somebody in the educational system did right by you, but it is a vastly different educational system now, and was made the worse by the excesses of the No Child Behind Left Act, which imposed all this BS testing on students and made sure that they not be taught, and that there be a metric created whereby we can declare the idea of public education just to be a terrible mistake that we need to walk away from and cut our losses.
Right, and have charter schools and money that would go further onto public education and private schools, or they could teach where there could be no monitoring or homeschooling, where there could be no government intervention.
Right. Hey, I just got to ask you, Tracy.
Mm-hmm.
What's the construction crew working on in the background?
I'm getting my nails done.
Are you real? Oh, okay.
I'm being.
I don't know. It sounded like a Dremel to me. I thought somebody might be doing some woodwork or.
No, actually, it is kind of like a Dremel.
Probably is a Dremel with the nail buffing attachment.
And that's what's being. I don't know.
I thought you were either. I didn't know. I didn't think nail salon. I was thinking maybe dentist, but I thought no, she's talking.
But it's, you know, I think about when I was in elementary school. And pretty much all into high school. And we had civics classes. I knew the preamble to the Constitution. I knew how to read I was taught how to read a map. I was taught about Congress and, you know, state assembly and stuff like that. And then I have a son who did not learn that stuff. I basically had to teach it to him. Because it was not taught to him when he was in school. When he came home one day and asked me something, he was in elementary school, and I just looked at him like, what? Why don't you know
that?
Yeah,
and see, I would say even with the, yeah, and I think your son's a little bit older than my kid, our kids here. But we had that same thing. I would dare say that our children here are probably more educated on the functions of government than 99% of their classmates. Because they're not getting in school, and we're having to teach it at home.
And we have to teach it at home. And I mean, I have to say that then when I went back to college, I learned, because I was a lot more interested in it than when I was in school, and I'm like, oh my God. And I just think about what has not been taught since I graduated from high school in 1984, as opposed to my son graduating from high school in 2006. So what's happening in the educational, you know, arena 22 years later, well, 22 years.
Well, see, graduating from high school in 1984, Tracy, you were graduating on the very back end of the last gasps of teaching civics in American schools.
Yep.
After that, it largely goes away. And by the 1990s, mm-hmm. it's gone. And only now is there any move afoot in the last couple of years to start teaching civics. I mean, for instance, it's part and parcel of why the PRISM series exists that we carry here on the Horn, because that's a concerted effort to teach history teachers how to teach history and civics and what it means
history
to be in, you know, what it means to have a popular government. And it's you know the idea, and it's all premised on teaching from primary sources, you know, the actual documents.
Yeah.
Which, for instance, that history book isn't, the one we were talking about earlier. And it makes a dramatic difference. You know, Texas Betsy's told me some stories about how she works in her classroom. And when you teach the real deal instead of teaching from some module and reading a script to children, it is a totally different experience both for the teacher, but more importantly for the students.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I look at how the difference in teaching, and like I said, once I went back to college, and I was like, wow. I mean, there's stuff that I've forgotten, and I'm thinking to myself, my God.
Well, if you ever treat yourself to a PRISM chat session, your mind will be straight up blown.
Well, it's just the fact I was like, you know, on one of the radio talk shows out here, they were talking about how everybody has gone crazy. There's somebody, people are committing suicide because our president won, and, you know, they're so afraid of what's going to happen because, you know, the world is going to go to the end and all this. And it's all about racist, you know, hatred. And the discussion of the radio show was, what can we do? And I said, it's two things, education and getting out of your comfort zone. Because like you said, if kids aren't being taught civics, or, you know, heaven forbid, ethnic studies, didn't they forbid ethnic studies?
Jeff Biggers and I never got around to talking about that in our conversation about Arizona a couple of nights ago, but it is a fact. The state of Arizona banned the teaching of Hispanic studies, American Indian studies, anything but white people studies.
And how do you do that? How is that? This is what troubles. This is what I'm wondering. How the hell is that allowed? How is it in this country?
Well, but Tracy, they got it because they turned the right wing. They turned the government of the state of Arizona over to. Well, not they. But basically white folks of the white wing in Arizona commandeered the government and rammed their agenda through, and it was an agenda from SB 1070 onward that was literally driven by people like Russell Pierce and that Klobuch creature from Kansas, who have I'm not kidding. Russell Pierce was associated with the Klan. Russell Pierce was associated with neo-Nazi movements. And that's what drove that agenda, and that agenda exists because they are racist. I mean,
and see, this is what about, like, my mom, I think I told you about the other day how my mom and I got into it about, you know, you shouldn't get so upset. I said, that's the problem. We as African Americans, I don't know if it's because of my mom's age. I mean, she was born out in California, so I don't get it. But there's still this difference. And I even find myself doing it every so... Yeah, me kowtowing to white people, believe it or not. But it's just, there's a difference that as a black person, especially somebody my age and older, we have, because this is what we were taught. You know, and don't make too many waves. And, you know, you could acknowledge that there's racism, but don't acknowledge it too loud. You know, don't confront the racism. And that's the problem. We are not confronting the racism. We're not saying to these people, you know, like Jan Brewer, what's her name? Jan Brewer. You know, this is how I would love for somebody, a reporter, to ask her or anybody of her ilk, and that sheriff is in Arizona. Explain to me. How, you say it's not racist. Well, explain to me how it's not. Explain to me how you telling me that...
Oh, don't ever ask them to explain to you how it's not racist, because then they will patiently explain to you, Tracy, that it's not racist because you're overly sensitive.
Oh, yeah, I'm overly sensitive. Yeah, I'm overly sensitive.
You know, Bugs Bunny. Yeah, too sensitive.
Yeah, I'm overly sensitive because you are saying that anything about my culture is not important enough to teach about. Anything about me being a woman, you know.
Well, teaching feminist studies or women's studies or African American studies or Latino studies or American Indian studies, that just further divides our nation. We can teach it all. They just ain't that much of it, so most of the history is white folk studies, but we'll teach you a little bit about, because there ain't much American Indian history, and there just ain't a heck of a lot of African American history. I mean, we give y'all a whole damn month every February.
And it's the shortest month of the year.
Well, there's that.
Well, it's so funny, because when I was applying to colleges,
And I actually got into what my essay was, why, because, you know, they asked the question, why do you want to study what you want to study? And I said, well, you know, when I was growing up in my history book, it was, we were slaves, Lincoln freed us, and then there was Martin Luther King.
Yeah, there's a few gaps in there.
There's a few gaps. And so as I grew, you know, like I said, I didn't go back to school until a few years ago, and I just sat there and I'm like, and then as a woman, I'm reading about civil rights and, you know, suffrage movements, and even as a woman, during the women's movement, black women were, we were kicked to the curb.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure none of those classes ever featured the Seneca meetings.
No. And see, that's what I'm saying. It's like, you know, as a cab driver, I am like one of the only, I mean, I am, I think, like the only black female, American female, black female in L.A. driver. Because I've seen a lot of women, not many, but I'm pretty sure I'm the only black woman driver. And so I'm in a predominantly male, you know, industry. And I had to fight. I had to literally, it's like these men looked at me, and Eastern European men and Middle Eastern men, you know, women are not, they're looked upon like chattel. And then I'm black on top of that. So I had to prove to these people that I am of worth. I, just because of how you talk to your women in your country or in your house, you're not going to talk to me that way. But you know what?
Because I will pull this cab over, and you will get out.
You will get out. But see, the thing is, I have commanded respect among men that would have never have even considered me a human being. You know, and it's because one thing, they've gotten to know me. Because the only other examples or any other, they don't know black people. And that's the problem. And I bet you, if some of these crackers, well, there's some people who, no matter what you say, they're not going to want to be around black people, bottom line. But there are some that it's just because they've never been around anybody else but their own. You know, and I feel, who was it? Zora Neale Hurston. You know what? She said something, you know, she was an amazing woman. And one of the things that she says, I feel sorry for anybody, she was talking about segregation, I feel sorry for anybody that doesn't want the pleasure of my company because basically I'm awesome. And poor you for not wanting to be around me. It's your loss. I mean, I'm definitely paraphrasing. But that was her sentiment. It's like, you just don't want to be around, not because I'm an awful person. I mean, like, I wouldn't want to be around Mitt Romney, not because of anything else, because he's an awful person. I wouldn't even want to be in the same hemisphere as him if I could help it. Because he's an awful, not because he's white, it's because he's an awful human being. And I use human being,
If we use the general yardstick of who's an asshole and who's not one, it makes telling who one wants to be around a hell of a lot easier than trying to guess at various shades of skin tone.
Right. I mean, like, I look at people like, you know, I'm dying to meet you, even though you are a hillbilly, but that's okay, I'll forgive you that.
Be nice, and I might bring some shine with me.
See, some rock gut.
No, not rock gut. This is good. This is good stuff.
I'll bring the ripple.
We went out to Vegas. No, it was out in Minneapolis. We drove out there two summers ago, and I took a pint of peach of shine with me. And I mean, it just blew the minds of these two. Well, our pals at Bubble Genius.
Okay.
They were like, what? And yeah, it's special.
Well, see, it's so funny because I don't know if it's the History Channel or one of those channels. You know, they're having a reality show about moonshine.
Yeah, I heard it. Know? Yeah, Ray was telling me about that a few minutes ago.
And I'm like, I've never had moonshine, but it's one of those, it's so funny. I've never had moonshine, and I can honestly say, even though at some point in my life I did live in South Central, I have never had a 40 or a blunt.
You have lived a sheltered and deprived life.
I have never had Old English. I've never had Colt 45 or a
Well, see, that's that thing about them blunts. is that, you know, that's a nasty-ass cigar they was using for them wrappers.
It's nasty, and they stink.
Yeah, I mean, what the hell's wrong with a damn zigzag? But then, well, you know, I'm dating myself, I guess.
But no, because it's like, you know, my son, you know, is one. See, how old is your oldest?
23.
Okay, so my son's a year older than
you. No, 24.
Oldest. Okay, yeah, my son's 24. And so have you started hearing the stories of the things that they did that you didn't know that they did, and then they feel that they're grown, they're telling you about it?
Truth be told, Tracy, no, because our oldest was so darn good, she made her mother and me feel bad about ourselves.
Well, my son is, you know, there was those times that I thought, you know, I found out, I'm recently finding out.
But we
out
are getting
cookies.
Some stories. There's breaking news now from the three younger ones, so they're making up for lost time.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, Alex, you know, I've been hearing the stories about the weed smoking and all this, and I'm like, oh. But I still thank God because, you know, if that's the worst that you did, I'm fine with that.
Our eldest, bless her heart, is so doggone good. It's not even funny. I mean, if she came to you and said that she'd tried to snort coke, she'd follow it up and saying, "But I just about drowned and it burnt my nose."
Right. See, you know, and it's kids like that, and you know, you're going when your children tell you things like that. Because even though my son, you know, he was definitely an angel, and everybody's like, well, how did you raise him so well? I said it was respect with underlying tones of fear.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's nothing like that paternal, that parental threat, credible death threat that just
right.
makes childhood,
you know,
right, yeah.
I brought you in.
Take you out.
And I will take you out. And, you know, and I said it with love. And like I tell people all the time, there's only been twice. I mean, I spanked Alex every so often, but there's only been two beatings that I might have, she'd have probably got to jail for. Once when he was five, because he was playing with matches, and it's not so much with playing with the matches, but he lied about it. And the second was when he was 13, 8-year gap, and he was ditching school, and I tried to kill him. I was like, I'm working every day, putting a roof over your head, and you know, doing this, and you're gonna ditch school? How dare you? How dare you? And you know, and we didn't have any more problems after that. Because basically I raised him, and I'm pretty sure like you raised your kids, you didn't have to do a lot of talking. You know, I don't see you as one of those repeating yourself parents. It's like you say it once, and that's it. And I don't.
Well, I hate
to
burst your bubble, but there's been a lot of talking.
Oh.
Because I can't stand to take a swing.
Well, no, when I say repeating my, you know, the talking, like, I mean, I did a lot more talking than swinging, trust. But it was at that, you know, I'm pretty sure that
you just find more stuff, more new stuff that needs talking about. Yeah.
Right. And like you, I'm pretty sure the way you talk about your beloved wife is that I'm pretty sure that Agnes had to do a look every so often. Like when somebody would get out of hand, it's like just that look. And it was like, okay, whatever I was doing, I'm going to stop this right now because she's giving me that I'm going to kill you look. And she does. And that's, to me, that's the beautiful part about
parents. Agnes ain't kidding.
Yeah, and see, and that's the beautiful part. What I love about being a mom, or what I love about being an adult.
Wait till you get to be a grandmother.
I'm looking forward to it. It's so funny. There's this little boy that my neighbor has a little boy. He's going to be 2 in January, and I am just head over heels in love with this boy so much
our little 5-year-old granddaughter, the eldest, has started into the public school system. And
how many pictures did you take of the first day of school?
Oh my God! but one day she came home and told her mama, and her mama relayed it to her mama, Agnes, that a little boy had said something mean to her.
Uh oh.
And Agnes was in her purse. I mean, she's getting the keys out. She, take care of this. Nobody does this.
This gonna be handled.
Ain't gonna happen twice.
No. Yeah. Well, it's like I told you.
But the other side of that is every now and then we'll get a story, and we'll say, "Yeah, it's too bad for you."
Right. It's like
to her mom. Right. Yeah.
It's like I told the story I told you, same age when with your granddaughter, when, you know, the old white woman kindergarten teacher told me that I spelled my name wrong, and I went home crying. And here comes my mom the next day up to school. You know, this is 1971, and my mom's 21 years old with her go-go boots. I can still see the outfit. There's just things that are imprinted on your brain. And we're talking, you know, 41 years later. And here's my mom with her go-go boots and her midi skirt and her Afro puff in that woman's face. How dare you tell my child? And like you said, didn't happen twice. And I know you got to go.
Yeah, I got to hit it. We're fresh out.
But Tracy,
I hope your nails are fabulous.
My nails are awesome. They look great. I feel human again because they were looking kind of raggedy. And I went to a different place and it cost me a small fortune, but that's okay. It's, you know, that's why I go to work every day.
Just don't chip one. Don't chip one. Just be careful.
I'll be careful.
Reach for the door handle real gentle-like.
Well,
Tracy, you have a good night, dear.
You too, my dear. Talk to you soon.
All right, bye now. Tracy, the lady cab driver, rounding out the program. Thanks, everybody, for helping us to get much closer to where we need to be fundraising-wise. Thank you for your ideas, your emails. Thank you for everything that you do that makes all of this worthwhile. Because this little experiment is about far more than anything I say. It's about what you say, what you think, and the dialogue that you promote. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky, our moderators in the chat room. Sparky, also the moderator of the Horn Malloy Skype chat on Friday nights on Skype. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to the lovely and beloved Agnes. Thank you to John Fox. Thank you to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. What an amazing story that is, the White Rose Society. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACACT.org. Go to ACACT.org and be part of the solution to Appalachia's agony. Go to Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and get yourself the coolest t-shirt on the planet. Save the endangered hillbilly. It will be a conversation starter wherever you go. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Rick Smith is, I hope, on the way, on the horn.